nothing to leave behind. Why didn't the Grimke men assemble in our defense? My anger dissipated, but my ignorance went on for another week. During those interminable days, Mother stayed in her chamber with a headache, and even Thomas refused my queries, saying it was Father's matter to disclose, not his. As it turned out, I would learn the news at a parlor concert held at one of the plantations northwest of the city. Mary and I arrived on the plantation as the afternoon turned gray with twilight, our carriage met by a bevy of peacocks that strolled about the grounds for no reason other than ornamentation. They created a beautiful blue shimmer in the fading light, but I found them a sad spectacle, the way they made little rushes at the air, going nowhere. The concert was already underway when I reached the parlor door. Burke slipped from his seat and greeted me with unusual warmth. He looked dashing in his long cerise vest and silk suit. "I was worried you weren't coming," he whispered, and led me quickly to the empty chair beside his. As I slipped off the emerald jacket that Handful had so wondrously crafted, he placed a letter upon my lap. I raised my brows to him as if to ask whether I should break the seal and read it while Miss Parodi and the harpsichord vied for the room. "Later," he mouthed. It was unconventional to pass a note in this manner, and my mind fretted throughout the program at what it might contain. When Mrs. Drayton, Thomas's mother-in-law, played the final piece on the harp, we adjourned to the dining room where the table was spread with a Charlotte Russe dessert and a selection of French wines, brandy, and Madeira, of which I couldn't partake for all my apprehension. Burke gulped brandy, then maneuvered me toward the front door. "Where are we going?" I asked, unsure of the propriety.
"Let's take a stroll."
We stepped onto the porch beneath the palladium fanlight and gazed at the sky. It was purple, almost watery-looking. The moon was rising over the tree line. I couldn't, however, think of anything but the letter. I pulled it from my purse and ripped the seal. "My dearest darling, I beg the privilege of becoming your most attached and devoted fiancé. My heart is yours. I await your answer. Burke." I read it once, then again, mildly disoriented, as if the letter he'd slipped to me earlier had been swapped for this one that had nothing at all to do with me. He seemed entertained by my confusion. He said,
"Your parents will want you to wait and give your answer after you've consulted with them."
"I accept your proposal," I said, smiling at him, overwhelmed with a queer mixture of jubilation and relief. "I would be married. I would not end up like Aunt Amelia Jane." He was right, though. Mother would be horrified I'd answered without her say-so. But I didn't doubt my parents' response. After swallowing their disapproval, they would seize upon the miracle of Burke Williams' proposal like it was the cure for a dread disease. We walked along the carriageway, my arm looped in his. A little tremor was running rib to rib to rib inside of me. Abruptly, he steered me off the path toward a camellia grove. We disappeared into the shadows that hung in swaths between the huge flowering bushes, and without preamble, he kissed me full on the mouth. I reared back.
Why,
you surprise me!
"My love, we're engaged now. Such liberties are allowed."
He drew me to him and kissed me again. His fingers moved along the edge of my décolletage, brushing my skin. I didn't entirely surrender, but I allowed Burke Williams a great amount of freedom during that small peccadillo in the camellia grove. When I mustered myself finally, pulling from his embrace, he said he hoped I didn't hold his ardor against him. I did not. I adjusted my dress. I tucked vagrant pieces of hair back into my upswept coif.
"Such liberties are allowed now."
As we walked back to the house, I fixed my eyes on the path, how it was riddled with peacock excrement and pebbles shining in the moon's light. This marriage, it would be life enough, wouldn't it? Surely. Burke was speaking about the necessity of a long engagement. A year, he said. As we drew near the porch, a horse whinnied, and then a man stepped from the front door and lit his pipe. It was Mr. Drayton, Thomas's father-in-law.
"Sarah?" he said. "Is that you?"
His eyes shifted to Burke and back to me. A lock of my hair fluttered guiltily at my shoulder.
"Where have you been?"
I heard the reproof, the alarm.
"Are you all right?"
I am. We are engaged. My parents weren't yet informed, and I'd heralded the news to Mr. Drayton, whom I barely knew, hoping it would excuse whatever his mind imagined we were doing out there.
"We took a quick turn in the night air," Burke said,
trying, it seemed, to bring some normalcy to the moment. Mr. Drayton was no fool. He gazed at me, plain Sarah, returning from a turn in the night with a startlingly handsome man, looking flushed and slightly unkempt.
"Well then, congratulations. Your happiness must be a welcome respite for your family, given this recent trouble of your father's."
Was father's trouble common knowledge, then?
"Has some misfortune fallen upon Judge Grimke?"
Burke asked.
"Sarah hasn't told you?"
I suppose I've been too distressed to speak of it," I said. "But please, sir, inform him on my behalf. It would be a service to me." Mr. Drayton took a draught from his pipe and blew the spicy smoke into the night.
"I regret to say the judge's enemies seek to remove him from the court. Impeachment charges have been brought."
I let my breath out. I couldn't imagine a greater humiliation for our father.
"On what grounds?"
Burke asked, properly outraged.
"They say he has grown biased and overly righteous in his judgments."
He hesitated.
"They charge incompetence. Ah, but it is all politics."
He waved his hand dismissively, and I watched the bowl of his pipe flare in the small wind. Any flicker of gladness I might have hoped for from my family about my engagement, any retribution I might have feared for accepting the proposal without permission, was swallowed by Father's trial. Mother's reaction to my announcement was simply,
"Well done, Sarah,"
as if reviewing one of my embroidery samplers. Father did not respond at all. Throughout the winter, he sequestered in the library day and night with Thomas, Frederick, and Mr. Daniel Hughey, a lawyer friend of Father's who was known for legally eviscerating his opponents. My hearing was almost preternatural, cultivated by years of unsanctioned listening, and I caught scraps of conversation while sitting at the card table in the main passage, pretending to read.
"John, you've received no money, no favors. You are accused of nothing that rises to the level of high crimes. Isn't a charge of incompetence bad enough? They accuse me of being biased. The streets and the papers are full of it. I'm ruined regardless."
"Father, you have friends in the legislative chamber."
"Don't be a fool, Thomas. What I have are enemies. Scheming bastards from the upcountry, seeking the bench for themselves.
They cannot possibly get a two-thirds majority."
"Make meat of them, Daniel. Do you hear me? Feed them to the dogs."
When the trial was heard that spring in the House of Representatives in Columbia, Mr. Hughey assailed Father's enemies with a vengeance, laying bare their political conniving with such force Father was acquitted in a single day. But the vote was ominously close, and he returned to Charleston, vindicated, but dirtied. At 59, Father was suddenly a very old man. His face had turned haggard, and his clothes baggy, as if he'd wilted inside them. A tremor appeared in his right hand. As the months passed, Burke paid courting calls to me weekly in the withdrawing room, where we were allowed unchaperoned visits. He filled these rendezvous with the same fever and excess we'd shared in the Camellia Grove, and I complied, drawing lines the best I could. I counted it God's miracle we weren't discovered, though I'm sure our invisibility was not due to God, but to the family's distraction. Father continued to shuffle and shrivel and tuck his hand in his pocket to hide its shake. He turned into a recluse of a man, and I turned into a Jezebel of a woman.
Handful. Mama couldn't sleep. She was up fussing around the cellar room like usual. She didn't know the meaning of the words quiet as a mouse. I was laying in the straw bed we'd always slept in, wondering what was on her mind this time. I'd stopped sleeping on the floor outside Sarah's room a long time back, just decided it on my own, and nobody said a word about it, not even Mrs. During those years, her meanness was hit and miss. Mama dragged the chair over to the high-up window so she could crane her neck and see a piece of sky beyond the wall. I watched how she sat there and studied it. Most of her waking nights, she would light the lamp and sew her story quilt. She'd been working on those quilt squares, bits at a time, for more than 2 years. "If they're a fire and I ain't here, that's what you get," she'd say. "You save the squares 'cause they pieces of me same like the meat on my bones." I pestered her all the time, wanting to see the squares she'd finished, but she held firm. Mama loved a good surprise. She wanted to unveil her quilt like they did marble statues. She had put her history on a quilt like the Fawn people, and she meant to show it all at once, not piecemeal. The day before, she told me, "You wait. I'm about ready to roll down the frame and start quilting it all together." She kept the squares locked in a wood trunk she dragged from the storeroom in the basement. The trunk had a bad, musty smell to it. Inside we found mold, dead moth eggs, and a little key. She cleaned the trunk with linseed oil, then locked the squares inside, wrapped in muslin. I guess she locked our freedom money in there too, 'cause right after that the bills disappeared from the gunny sack. Last time I'd counted, she'd save up $400 even. Laying in bed now, I did the numbering in my head. We needed $650 more to buy the both of us. I broke the quiet. "Is this how you gonna be all night? Sit in the dark and stare up at a hole in the wall?" "It's something to do. Go on back to sleep." "Go on back to sleep? That was a lot of useless. Where do you keep the key to the chest? Is that how you gonna be? Lay there figuring out how to peek at my quilt? The key hid on the back of nowhere." I let it be, and my mind drifted off to Sarah. I didn't care for this Mr. Williams. The only thing he'd ever said to me was, "Remove yourself hastily." I'd been building a fire in the drawing room so the man could get himself warm, and that's what he had to say, "Remove yourself hastily." I couldn't see Sarah married to him any more than I could see myself married to Goodis. He still trailed after me, wanting you know what. Mama said, "Tell him go jump in the lake." Yesterday, Sarah had asked, "When I marry, would you come with me to live?" "Leave Mama?" Real quick, she said, "Oh, you don't have to. I just thought, well, I'll miss you." Even though we didn't have much to say to each other anymore, I hated to think about us parting. "I reckon I'll miss you too," I told her. Across the room, Mama said, "How old do you reckon I is?" She never did know her age for sure. Didn't have a record. "Seems I had you when I'm about the same old as you now. And you 19, what that make me?" I counted in my head. "You 38. "That ain't too old," she said. We stayed like that a while. Mom was staring at the window, mulling over her age and me laying in bed wide awake now, when she cried out, "Look, Handful! Look here!" She leapt to her feet, bouncing on her knees. "There go another one!" I bolted from the bed. The stars, she said. They fallin' just like they done for your granny mama. Come on, hurry. We yanked on our shoes and sack coats, snatched up an old quilt, and we're out the door. Mama tearing across the workyard, me 2 steps behind. We spread the quilt on the ground out in the open behind the spirit tree and lay down on top of it. When I look up, the night opened and the stars poured down. Each time a star streaked by, Mama laughed low in her throat. When the stars stopped falling and the sky went still, I saw her hands rub the little mound of her belly. And I knew then what it was she wasn't too old for.
Sarah. Sarah, you should sit down. Please. That was how Thomas began. He gestured toward the 2 chairs beside the window that overlooked the piazza. But it was I alone who sat. It was 12:30, and here was my brother, the au courant of Charleston barristers, interrupting his lawyering to speak with me in the privacy of my room. His face was pale with what I took to be dread. Naturally, my mind went to Father. One could scarcely look at him these days without worrying about him. This thin, hollowed-out man with the uncertain gait and erratic hand. Despite that, there had been some improvement lately. Enough that he'd returned to his duties on the bench. Just the week before, I'd come upon Father laboring along the main passage with his cane. It had conjured up an old Sunday school image from our catechism of Lazarus hobbling from the tomb with his shroud cleaving to his ankles. Father's left hand was shaking as if waving to a passerby. And before he saw me, he grabbed it violently, trying to subdue it. Noticing me, he said,
"Oh, Sarah, God is ruthless to the aged."
I walked with him to the back door, moving with a corresponding slowness that only called attention to his feebleness.
"So tell me, when will you marry?"
It was the only question anyone asked me now, but coming from Father, it brought me to a standstill. I'd been promised to Burke since last February, and not once had Father even mentioned it. I hadn't blamed him for missing the engagement party, which Thomas and Sally had graciously hosted. He'd been bedridden then. But there'd been so many months of silence since. "I don't know," I answered. "Burke is waiting on his father to assign the business over to him. He wants to be in the proper position."
"Does he?"
His tone was sardonic, and I made no attempt to answer. It was difficult now to remember those times when Father had let me plunder his books and basked in my speeches. There'd been a kind of invisible cord running between us then, and I tried to think exactly when it had been broken. The day he forbade me books? Thomas's farewell party, when he hurled his vicious words?
"You shame yourself. You shame us all. Where did you get the notion that you could study the law?" "I remind you, Sarah, there is no divorce law in our state,"
he was saying.
"Once you are married, the contract is indissoluble. You are aware of this?"
"Yes, Father, I know." He nodded with what seemed like bleak acceptance. That was where my mind alighted in those final moments before Thomas delivered his news. Upon Father, and my last encounter with him. Upon his frailty.
"You've always been my favorite sister," Thomas said. "You know that. In truth, you've been the favorite of all my siblings."
He paused, stalling, gazing through the window across the piazza into the garden. I watched a drop of perspiration slide to his temple and cling in the net of wrinkles that was already forming. A strange resignation settled on me. "Whatever it is, it has already happened." "Please, I'm not as fragile as you might think. Tell me plainly."
"You're right. I will simply say it.
I'm afraid Burke Williams has misrepresented himself to you. It has come to my attention that he has other female acquaintances. Without considering the hidden entendre, I said, surely that's not a crime. Sarah, these acquaintances, they're also his fiancées. I knew suddenly what he said was true. So many things made sense now. The delay in naming a marriage date, the incessant trips he made to visit family or conduct business, the curious fact that someone so full of looks and charm had settled on me. My eyes filled. Thomas dug for his handkerchief and waited while I dabbed them dry. "How did you learn of this?" I asked, composed.